Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the Huffington Post, America Without a Middle Class by Elizabeth Warren. Can you imagine an America without a strong middle class? If you can, would it still be America as we know it? Today, one in five Americans is unemployed, underemployed, or just plain out of work. One in nine families can't make the minimum payment on their credit cards. One in eight mortgages is in default or foreclosure. One in eight Americans is on food stamps. More than 120,000 families are filing for bankruptcy every month. The economic crisis has wiped out more than $5 trillion from pensions and savings, has left family balance sheets upside down, and threatens to put 10 million homeowners out on the street. Families have survived the ups and downs of economic booms and busts for a long time, but the fall behind during the busts has gotten worse, while the surge ahead during the booms has stalled out. In the boom of the 1960s, for example, median family income jumped by 33%, adjusted for inflation. But the boom of 2000s resulted in an almost imperceptible 1.6% increase for the typical family. While Wall Street executives and others who owned lots of stock celebrated how good the recovery was for them, middle-class families were left empty-handed. The crisis facing the middle class started more than a generation ago. Even as productivity rose, the wages of the average fully employed male have been flat since the 1970s. But the core expenses kept going up. By the early 2000s, families were spending twice as much, adjusted for inflation, on mortgages than they did a generation ago for a house that was, on average, only 10% bigger and 25 years older. They also had to pay twice as much to hang on to their health insurance. To cope, millions of families put a second parent into the workforce. But higher housing and medical costs combined with new expenses for childcare, the cost of a second car to get to work, and higher taxes combined to squeeze families even harder. Even with two incomes, they tightened their belts. Families today spend less than they did a generation ago on food, clothing, furniture, appliances, and other flexible purchases, but it hasn't been enough to save them. Today's families have spent all their income, have spent all their savings, and have gone into debt to pay for college, to cover serious medical problems, and just to stay afloat a little while longer. Through it all, families never asked for a handout from anyone, especially Washington. They were left to go on their own, working harder, squeezing nickels, and taking care of themselves. But their economic boats have been taking on water for years, and now the crisis has swamped millions of middle-class families. The contrast with the big banks could not be sharper. While the middle class has been caught in an economic vice, the financial industry that was supposed to serve them has prospered at their expense. Consumer banking, selling debt to middle-class families, has been a gold mine. Boring banking has given way to creative banking, and the industry has generated tens of billions of dollars annually in fees made possible by deceptive and dangerous terms buried in the fine print of opaque, incomprehensible, and largely unregulated contracts. And when various forms of this creative banking triggered economic crisis, the banks went to Washington for a handout. All the while, top executives kept their jobs and retained their bonuses. Even though the tax dollars that supported the bailout came largely from middle-class families, from people already working hard to make ends meet, the beneficiaries of those tax dollars are now lobbying Congress to preserve the rules that had left those huge banks feast off the middle class. Pundits talk about populist rage as a way to trivialize the anger and fear coursing through the middle class. But they have it wrong. Families understand with crystalline clarity that the rules they have played by are not the same rules that govern Wall Street. They understand that no American family is too big to fail. They recognize that business models have shifted and that big banks are pulling out all the stops to squeeze families and boost revenues. They understand that their economic security is under assault and that leaving consumer debt effectively unregulated does not work. Families are ready for change. According to polls, large majorities of Americans have welcomed the Obama administration's proposal for a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, the CFPA. The CFPA would be answerable to consumers, not to banks, and not to Wall Street. The agency would have the power to end tricks and traps pricing and to start leveling the playing field so that consumers have the tools they need to compare prices and manage their money. The response of the big banks has been to swing into action against the agency, fighting with all their lobbying might to keep business as usual. They are pulling out all the stops to kill the agency before it is born. And if those practices crush millions more families, who cares, so long as the profits stay high and the bonuses keep coming. America today has plenty of rich and super rich. But it has far more families who did all the right things, but who still have no real security. Going to college and finding a good job no longer guarantee economic safety. Paying for a child's education and setting aside enough for a decent retirement have become distant dreams. Tens of millions of once secure middle-class families now live paycheck to paycheck, watching as their debts pile up and worrying about whether a pink slip or a bad diagnosis will send them hurtling over an economic cliff. America without a strong middle class? Unthinkable. But the one solid foundation is shaking. And that's by Elizabeth Warren, who is the Gottlieb Professor of Law at Harvard and is currently the chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel. And as an additional point, you can go to creditcardreform.org to add your voice to the effort of dealing with the banks that are borrowing for almost nothing and charging ahead to get the American families interest rates at 25% or more. The card game is rigged, and it's about time customers spoke with one voice. So again, go to the website creditcardreform.org to add your voice to the effort of dealing with this unacceptable way these banks are performing. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Continuing on with the second segment of the show, I have been looking at the two-income trap, why middle-class mothers and fathers are going broke. And this is really the textbook written by Professor Warren with some surprising solutions that will change our children's futures. I note that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren-Tyagi, who are two of America's great champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also go back on all the shows that have been produced at www.kruufm.com. Look in the archives, Life and Debt, and you can listen to all the prior shows that will help you deal with substantial debt problems, and even better yet, preventing them in the first place. Last week, I ended with the analysis of contending with the bidding war for houses in safe neighborhoods with better schools. According to Professor Warren, this is really one of the primary reasons why home prices have escalated. She suggested a voucher system regarding public education, and this is a taxpayer-funded voucher that paid the entire cost of educating a child, not just a partial subsidy, and it would open a range of opportunities to all children. With fully funded vouchers, parents of all income levels could send their children and the accompanying financial support to the schools of their choice. As a result, middle-class parents who use state funds to send their kids to school would be able to live in the neighborhood of their choice or the neighborhood of their pocketbook. Fully funded vouchers would relieve parents from the terrible choice of leaving their kids in lousy schools or bankrupting themselves to escape those schools. So that's the voucher system in a nutshell. And an all-voucher system would be a shock to the educational system, but the shakeout might be just what the system needs. In the short run, a large number of parents would likely chase a limited number of spots in a few excellent schools. But over time, the whole concept of the Beverly Hills schools or the Newton schools would die out, replacing the hierarchy by schools that offer a variety of programs that parents want for their children, regardless of the geographic boundaries. By selecting where to send their children and where to spend their vouchers, parents would take control over school tax dollars, making them the de facto owners of the schools. Parents, not administrators, would decide on the programs, student-teacher ratios, and whether to spend money on art or sports, for example. Parents' competitive energies would be channeled toward signing up early or improving their children's qualifications for a certain school, not bankrupting themselves to buy homes they cannot afford. If a meaningful public school voucher system were instituted, the U.S. housing market would change forever. These changes might dampen and perhaps even depress housing prices in some of today's most competitive neighborhoods. But these losses would be offset by other gains. Owners of older homes in urban centers might find more willing buyers, and the urge to flee the cities might abate. Urban sprawl might slow down as families recalculate the cost of living so far from work. At any rate, the change would cause a one-time readjustment. The housing market would normalize, with supply and demand more balanced, and families freed from ruinous mortgages. So let's look at the price of education. Even with that perfect house in a swanky school district, parents still are not covered when it comes to educating their kids, not by a long shot. The notion that taxpayers foot the bill for educating middle-class children has become a myth in yet another way. The two ends of the spectrum, everything that happens before a child shows up for the first day of kindergarten and after he's handed his high school diploma, fall directly on the parents. Preschool and college, which now account for one-third or more of the years a typical middle-class kid spends in school, are paid for almost exclusively by the child's family. Preschool has almost always been a privately funded affair, at least for most middle-class families. What has changed is its role for middle-class children. Over the past generation, the image of preschool has transformed from an optional stopover for little kids to a prerequisite for elementary school nowadays. Parents have been inundated with articles telling them that early education is important for everything from pre-reading skills to social development, etc. As one expert in early childhood education observes, in many communities around the country, kindergarten is no longer aimed at the entry level, and the only way mom and dad feel they can get their child prepared is through a pre-kindergarten program. Middle-class parents have stepped into line with the experts' recommendations. Today, nearly two-thirds of America's 3- and 4-year-olds attend preschool, compared with just 4% in the mid-60s. Again, two-thirds of America's 3- and 4-year-olds attend preschool. This isn't just the byproduct of more mothers entering the workforce. Nearly half of all stay-at-home moms now send their kids to a pre-kindergarten program. As Newsweek put it, the science says it all. Preschool programs are neither a luxury nor a fad, but a real necessity. And so what follows from this? As the demand has heated up, many families have found it increasingly difficult to find a pre-kindergarten program with an empty slot. As one California mother describes about trying to get her children into preschool, she said, "Just trying to get an application to any old preschool can be met with more attitude than the maitre d' at Le Cirque. If you should be naive enough to ask if there will be openings in the next session, you may be reminded that there are always more applicants than openings, or the person might just laugh at you and hang up." Now, these remarks may be tongue-in-cheek, and pundits love to mock the parent who subscribes to the theory that if little Susie doesn't get into the right preschool, she'll never make it into the right medical school. But the shortage of quality preschool programs is very real. Child development experts have rated daycare centers, and the news is not good. The majority are lumped in the poor to mediocre range. Not surprisingly, preschools with strong reputations often have long, long waiting lists. So once again, today's parents find themselves caught in a trap. A generation ago, when nursery school was regarded as little more than a chance for mom to take a break, parents could consider the economics in a fairly detached way, committing to pay no more than what they could afford. And when only a modest number of parents were shopping for those preschool slots, the price had to remain low to attract a full class. Today, when scores of experts routinely proclaim that preschool is decisive in a child's development, but a slot in a preschool, any preschool, can be hard to come by, parents are in a poor position to shop around for lower prices. So the laws of supply and demand take hold in the opposite direction, eliminating the pressure for preschool programs to keep prices low as they discover that they can increase fees without losing pupils. A full-day program in a pre-kindergarten offered by the Chicago Public School District costs over $7,000 a year now, more than the cost of a year's tuition at the University of Illinois. High? Well, yes, but that hasn't deterred parents. At just one Chicago public school, there are 95 kids on a waiting list for 20 slots. That situation is fairly typical. According to one study, the annual cost for a 4-year-old to attend a child care center in an urban area is more than double the price of college tuition in 15 states. And so today's middle-class families simply spend and spend, searching their budgets to give their children the fundamentals of a modern education. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I've been talking about the cost of school, just recently the cost of preschool, and ended with the thought that the annual cost for a four-year-old to attend a child care center in an urban area is more than double the price of college tuition in 15 states. So this has a huge impact on middle-class families. It seems that the solution here is fairly obvious. We should extend the scope of public education. If Americans generally believe that educational programs should begin at age 3, why should public education wait to kick in at the age of 5 or 6? The decision about how old children should be when they start school was made more than a century ago, when views about the learning capacity of young children were very different. The absence of publicly funded preschool is an anachronism, one that could easily be remedied. When we look to our politicians, there are a host of politicians who do propose publicly funded universal preschool, and frankly, Professor Warren and I agree. It's time to do it. Professor Warren also looks at the concept of taxpayer-funded daycare. Unlike preschool, the primary mission of most daycare programs is not to educate children, but to provide surrogate childcare when parents are at work. For more than 2 decades, women's groups, labor unions, and liberal politicians have been pressing the government to foot the bill for daycare. Blocked by conservatives, advocates of free daycare have had little success, but that hasn't stopped the clamor. So Professor Warren takes a look at this sacred cow. How much help would subsidized daycare really offer to middle-class families? It certainly would be a big help for poorer families whose paychecks can barely cover even low-quality childcare. But what about the average two-parent middle-class family? Government-sponsored daycare would ease the immediate cost pressures on some families, but the long-term financial implications are more complex. Unlike the money that the government spends on public safety or education, which benefit every child, subsidized daycare benefits only some kids, those whose parents both work outside the home. Daycare subsidies offer no help for families with a stay-at-home mother. In fact, such subsidies would make financial life more difficult for these families because they would create yet another comparative disadvantage for single-income families trying to compete in the marketplace. Every dollar spent to subsidize the price of daycare frees up a dollar for the two-income family to spend in the bidding wars for housing, tuition, and everything else that families are competing for, widening the gap between single and dual-income families. Not good. Any subsidy that benefits working parents without providing a similar benefit to single-income families pushes the stay-at-home mother and her family further down the economic ladder. In effect, government-subsidized daycare would add one more indirect pressure on mothers to join the workforce. So Professor Warren asks, does that mean that publicly supported daycare is a bad idea? Well, not necessarily. If it were part of a package that also improved public education from kindergarten through high school, the bidding war implications of a daycare subsidy would be muted. Also, daycare subsidies could be accompanied by offsetting support for single-income families, such as tax credits for stay-at-home parents, which would help level the playing field between single and dual-income families. Besides, public-supported daycare would have very real benefits for society at large, not the least of which would be to raise the standards of care for millions of children who currently receive inadequate attention while their parents are at work. So that's the preschool and the daycare side of the spectrum. Now let's jump to the other side of the education spectrum, for which American parents are advised to start stashing away money before their little ones can even finger paint, let alone choose a major. So the answer is college, the other end of the spectrum. Now Americans are a fairly contentious lot. They express an astonishing variety of opinions about politics and religions, sports teams, movies, vitamin supplements, workout preferences, and even workplace dress codes. They even disagree on the basic facts of history. According to one recent poll, 6% of our fellow citizens believe that the Apollo moon landings were faked. But there is one topic on which Americans overwhelmingly agree: the importance of a college education. According to a recent survey, 97% of Americans agree that a college degree is absolutely necessary or helpful, compared with a scant 3% claiming that a degree is not that important. So in other words, Americans are twice as likely to believe that man never walked on the moon as they are to believe that a college degree doesn't matter. So in our diverse culture full of contrarians who relish their differences with one another, faith in the power of higher education is the new secular religion. Americans now see a college degree as the single most important determinant of a young person's chances of success, even more significant than getting along well with others or having a good work ethic. Now, a generation or so ago, Americans were more likely to believe that there were many avenues for a young person to make his way into the middle class, including paths that didn't require a degree. Just look at your own families from a generation ago. Some of the people went to college and some of them didn't. A generation ago, education was valued, but no one in your neighborhood would have claimed it was the single most important determinant of a young person's success. I'm an example of this. One of three kids, and I was the only one to go to college. The other two learned skilled trades. Now today, 77% of adults say that getting a college education is more important than it was just 10 years ago. And 87% believe that a college education has become as important as a high school diploma used to be. Middle-class parents, obeying the dictate that college is essential in the new economy, have found themselves combatants in yet another active bidding war. Once again, supply and demand are out of balance. The number of the students aiming for a spot in a decent four-year institution is rising every year, while the number of openings at the major public and private universities stays essentially the same. This is true not just at Harvard and Princeton, but also at the big state universities. The open admission policies that once ensured pretty much everyone a slot at the state university have virtually disappeared. Indeed, many state universities no longer have room even for average students, let alone struggling ones. For example, the University of Wisconsin recently announced that the majority of its student body graduated in the top 10% of their high school classes. Not every child can be in the top 10%, and parents can find themselves in a bind. For the growing number of parents whose kids don't make it into the local public university, there may be little choice but to come up with $25,000 or more now a year for tuition, room, and board at a private college. So we'll continue analyzing this end of the financial education spectrum next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.